You're listening to Around Comics, episode 152. Another Monday edition of Around Comics, the comic culture podcast. I'm Christopher Niesman, and I'll be your guide for the next hour of comic book news, information, and entertainment. Coming up on today's episode, we talk with writer Jason Aaron. Brian Salazar is here to keep you up to date on all of the industry happenings in wire-to-wire comic book news. Chris Marshall lets us know what's coming out in new trade paperback and collected editions this week. Tom Caters returns as the Answer Man. We take a look into the private life of Hawkman. Jeremy Mullins and Will Pfeiffer are here as well with webcomic and DVD recommendations. All that and more is next on Around Comics. Before we get started, I want to let you know that this episode of Around Comics is brought to you by The Overman.
December 5th, Image Comics presents a final vision of the future. The Overman is a 5-issue limited series that follows hired killer Nathan Fisher on a journey to stop an apocalyptic union of mankind and machine. Broken Frontier calls it a story to be grand in scope. Mark Waid says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Give the gift of destruction this holiday season. For more information, go to theovermancomic.com.
In the fall of 2006, everyone at Around Comics was frankly kind of surprised by how much they enjoyed a new miniseries from Vertigo called The Other Side. It was the first time that we had taken note of writer Jason Aaron, and his dark, gripping depiction of the Vietnam War reminded us how powerful the comics medium can be. After The Other Side, Jason brought us the ongoing series, also from Vertigo, called Scalped. He's also worked on Wolverine, and it's just been announced that he'll be doing a 4-issue run on Wolverine, as well as taking over writing duties for Ghost Rider. Around Comics is happy to welcome back to the program writer Jason Aaron. Jason, it's always good to hear from you. How you doing?
Doing great. How you doing, Chris?
Oh, fantastic. And even better since we heard the news that you're going to be taking over Wolverine and Ghost Rider. So, first of all, congratulations on that.
Thanks. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. So it's going to be an exciting year next year for me.
Absolutely. And I wanted to touch on that. It was about a year ago that we had talked with you, and The Other Side was coming out, and you had mentioned the series Scalp that you were working on, and you were very much new to a lot of comic readers. How has 2007 rounded out for you? It seems like it's been a pretty exciting and successful year for you.
Yeah, it's been amazing. The Other Side and Scalped were both kind of long in the works. I was working with Vertigo for really almost 2 years before those books came out. But then once they started coming out, things just kind of snowballed, and one thing has led to another. And yeah, it turned out to be a busy year for me, and next year looks to be even busier.
You know, this is something that I think a lot of comic creators go through, is that breakthrough year or that breakthrough series, and all of a sudden you go from constantly scampering for work, and now you may be faced with not more work than you can take on, but you may be faced with having to decide on projects. How do you try and pace yourself to make sure that you're giving your best work on whatever series that you're working on?
Well, you know, I've just been figuring all that out for myself just over the last few months, really. Like you said, I went from, you know, this time last year, I wouldn't have said no to anything. I wasn't doing anything other than The Other Side and Scalped, and I was really way ahead or pretty much done with all of those, with both of those. So, yeah, and, you know, now I'm at the point where I have had to kind of turn down a few things because I had to be cautious about saying yes to too many things. And I talked with Matt Fraction sometimes, and, you know, he says a bad week for him is maybe 18 pages that he gets written. So, you know, one book a week is a bad week for him. For me, you know, I'm still figuring out how much I can do on a monthly basis. So, yeah, I've had to be cautious about saying yes to too many projects. But, you know, it's a great problem to have.
Yeah, does it ever scare you whenever you turn one down and you're like, oh, man, I hope that's not the last offer I get for a while?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, the first time I had to turn something down, it was really scary. You know, I didn't want to say yes to too many things, and then, you know, your work starts to suffer, and you're not doing yourself any favors. So, yeah, I've tried to be cautious.
Well, one of the things that we see or saw with The Other Side, and we're seeing now with Scalp, is that those are pretty heavily researched books. You can't walk into projects that are that specific and not have that heavily researched. As you start to approach your Marvel work a little bit more with Wolverine and Ghost Rider, is the amount of research that you have to do for those any less, or do you research for those just as much?
Well, it's been less, but yeah, they both still require research. You know, with the Wolverine arc that I'm doing, I have had to dig out a lot of back issues and check different parts of the character's history. And even then, I've been told no on different things by my editors, just because you're contradicting something that from 15 years ago. So yeah, it still requires research, but you know, it's not really the same as something like The Other Side or Scout.
It's a much different research. It's continuity research, which a lot of people do for fun, but if you had to do it for a job, I can see how that could be a little mind-numbing to keep up, especially with X-Men history.
Oh, yeah, because you're talking about so many books, especially with Wolverine. So many books, and, you know, so a lot of them from that period when, you know, Marvel wasn't really maybe producing the best stuff in the world, mm-hmm. You know, back in the early 90s when everything was selling like crazy. So yeah, some of those aren't the most fun stuff in the world to read, but still, you know, that's not a bad complaint to have about your job, is that you get to spend time reading old comic books.
Yeah, there are worse things in life, right?
Oh yeah.
Well,
they're way better than any real job I've ever had.
Well, talking about Wolverine and the I don't want to call it a one shot, but the one issue that you did bridging, what was the Jeff Loeb and the Mark Guggenheim runs here,
yeah,
a couple months ago. I want to talk about that issue. It was definitely one of the coolest Wolverine issues I've read in a long time, because you put a very different spin on that character than we're used to. It still was very much in his personality, but we saw Logan do things that I don't think a lot of comic fans have seen before. How did you approach that issue and decide to have Logan be the type of character that he was in that?
Well, the story came about just from Axel, editor Axel and Alonzo and I talking, and it was the basic idea was his, of he wanted me to put Wolverine in this situation and then figure out how does he get out of it. And we kind of both hit on the same idea at the same time. And we were both thinking of the scene from Silence of the Lambs where you hear that Hannibal Lecter has made the guy in the cell next to him kill himself just by whispering to him during the night. And just
sure.
That idea was it's such a terrifying idea, just to have that power. That's exactly what we wanted to try to get across with that issue, that Wolverine, you know, even when he can't use his claws, can be just that dangerous.
Sure, it's one of the aspects of his power. Everyone always seems to focus on the claws and his ability to regenerate. And sometimes you'll see that the heightened senses will be used in a story, but you really made that a central part of that story, in him using his senses as a way of, his deductive reasoning really came off of that. And he was really almost a detective in that story.
Thanks. It's a blast to do, especially working with Howard Chaykin.
Yeah, we'll bounce around here and talk about a couple of your other books. Since you mentioned Howard Chaykin, I was going to mention some of the artists that you've worked with, and that being Cameron Stewart on The Other Side, Aaron Guara on Scalped, and Howard Chaykin on Wolverine. That's a pretty impressive stable of artists that you've been able to kind of get your mainstream comics riding off the ground with. What's it like working with each one of those guys?
Oh, it's been great, especially for my, first three big projects. You can't have a much better start than that. They've all been very different to work with, but each one of them are just incredible artists and, great guys to learn from. I still feel like I'm learning, what the hell I'm doing. I've only written, 20-something comics at this point, so, that's nothing compared to most guys.
Howard Chaykin's been working in comics for over 25 years now, probably.
He's had more years in comics than I have comics. So it was very intimidating when I found out he was going to do it. And I went down to my back issue boxes and dug out, my issues of Black Hawk and American Flag and all of his past work, and was flipping through them and thinking, I'm going to write a script for Howard Chaykin. I'm going to write a great Howard Chaykin script. And then I realized, I can't do this. I can't write I'm not Howard Chaykin. I can't write a Howard Chaykin script. So, I just tried to write a script that I thought I was giving him a lot to sink his teeth into. And, I was blown away by what he did with it.
Yeah, it was pretty outstanding. I know, you're a great case of, I don't want to say, the cliche term, a fanboy made good, but you grew up a comics fan and you were very tenacious in how you got into the industry. And, we talked about it before and other people have mentioned it, that you basically just wouldn't give up until you got a job writing comics. How fulfilling has it been for you to finally, break through after really trying for several years to get into this industry?
It's been crazy. It's still surreal sometimes. I look back and, like you said, it's taken me several years to get to this point, but in a way it still seems like it was just yesterday where I couldn't get anybody to return my emails, or I couldn't get any comic project off the ground. And I still kind of sit back and wonder sometimes, like, how the hell did I pull this off? How the hell did I get here? Because, for years it was my dream to be able to quit my crappy day job and stay home and write comics. And suddenly that's what I'm doing, so.
And there you are. I know from past conversations, Will Dennis was one of the editors at Vertigo that really championed a lot of your stuff. You still working with Will on Scout, correct?
Yeah. Will was the guy who I emailed about The Other Side. I just emailed him out of the blue because he had worked on the Garth Ennis War Stories books. Figured he was a good guy to pitch a war story to. And, he turned me down a couple times, but I was politely persistent and somehow convinced him to give my script a read. And, if he hadn't done that, I wouldn't be doing anything right now. So, yeah, I owe Will a lot, and he's my editor on Scout. And, as long as I'm able to write comics, I plan on doing something with Will and doing something with Vertigo.
Want to move over to your other new Marvel project, and it's one that a lot of people were instantly excited about whenever they saw that you were going to be taking over the title, and that's Ghost Rider. What's the plan for when you're going to take over the series, and do you have any idea on how long the plan is to keep you on Ghost Rider?
My first issue is 20, which ships in February, and as far as I know, I'm the only ongoing writer. And, we've talked about maybe 2 years. I'm going to be there for the long haul.
That's a character that is ultimately cool in its concept. I mean, how can you not like the idea of a flaming spirit of vengeance on a motorcycle? It's just, it's a
exactly,
cool, yeah, it's a cool concept. but it just seems like such a hard character to write. How are you approaching Ghost Rider?
I haven't seen it as a hard character to write. I think, anytime you have these characters that have really convoluted histories, the best thing is just to boil them down to really what made them cool in the first place and, try to excise as much of that history as you can just to make things accessible for people. Johnny Blaze, I love, obviously, if you look at my body of work, I love writing tortured, flawed characters. In terms of the Marvel Universe, Johnny Blaze is about as tortured and flawed as you can get.
Absolutely.
So I've been having a blast. I don't see him as a hard character to write at all.
Now, are you jumping right into continuity of the existing series, or whenever you take over, is it going to be a new direction for the character? Obviously, a good jumping on point for people that want to, if they're not reading Ghost Rider now, to start picking it up?
Yes, it is a new direction, but it spins out of what Daniel Way is doing in his final arc. His arc ends with 19, and issue 18 has got a big revelation that kind of changes what we think we know about the Ghost Rider. He's leaving me in a specific spot, and I'm going from there. But it's still a new direction, and it is a good jumping on point for readers. I mean, Daniel's wrapping up his storylines, and we're going off in a new direction.
I don't know how much you can talk about the series or your plans for it, but as a general feel, are you planning on keeping the character kind of street level or keeping the character, closer to this plane of existence, I guess? Or are you really going to work off of the whole spirit of vengeance and heaven and hell aspect of the character?
It'll really be a mix of all that. Kind of the idea of what I'm going for is Alan Moore's American Gothic storyline that he did in Swamp Thing, where he had Swamp Thing traveling around to these different parts of the country and getting involved in these different little horror stories that kind of all connected together.
Sure.
From this bigger picture. That's what I'm trying to do. The opening arc of my Ghost Rider, it takes place in this tiny little town in the middle of nowhere in Montana with Ghost Rider coming there looking for some answers and, of course, getting the proverbial more than he bargained for. And, each arc is going to be in a different location, different type of story, but things that all connect together to this bigger picture.
You talk about different locations. Is it nice to be in the Marvel Universe and working with a Marvel character, but not to be pulled into, Manhattan and Marvel's New York, or even in what's going on in the broader Marvel landscape? I don't think that we have to worry about Ghost Rider being a Skrull.
See, now you just ruined the second year of my run on the book. Thanks.
You know what I mean? Is it nice to write a character in the Marvel U that isn't caught up in all of the current, event continuity?
Like you said about New York, I don't think I could write a book set in New York. I've been there just a handful of times, and, I grew up in the South, and I live now in the Midwest, and, I'm just more attracted to stories taking place outside of New York and L.A. and what my, some of my friends affectionately refer to as flyover country. I'm more interested in flyover country. So, that's what we'll be exploring. And Ghost Rider may also be popping up in different parts of the world. It won't just be the country. It's going to be traveling all over.
Well, we're in Chicago, which is the flyover capital.
That's right, yeah.
I know how you feel. So is Ghost Rider maybe going to make a stop in Kansas City?
Don't plan yet, but Wolverine might be popping up in Kansas City.
Oh, very nice.
Not to change subject, but yeah.
It's always nice to write about your home turf, and it's something that I always like to see whenever our favorite heroes come to the Midwest.
Well, it makes the research easy, I can just go down the street and snap a picture, and there we go.
Who's your artist going to be on Wolverine?
On Wolverine is Ron Garney.
The guy from Spider-Man is going to be coming over and doing everyone's favorite half-pint mutant. That's exciting. I love Ron Garney's work.
Yeah, he's great, and he's finished up the second issue now, and it looks tremendous. I've been really, really happy with it. I've been really, really lucky with the artists I've been paired with. And, I mean, maybe at some point I'll work with some guy who's just an asshole. I don't know, but so far I have no complaints. I've been really lucky.
That's awesome. And then on Ghost Rider, who's been tabbed to take over those duties?
It's a new artist. He's a French artist. His name is Roland Boschke.
Well, he's a new artist, and he's French, so he could be an asshole.
But he's not. He's a good guy. He's done, I think, just a little bit of comic stuff. Nothing big here in the States, but he's mostly done storyboards and character designs for cartoons. Like you worked on the that last Fantastic Four cartoon.
Oh wow! Okay. Well, you've already had pretty good success with foreign artists.
Gareth, he lives in Spain, but he's Serbian.
Okay, a Serbian living in Spain, and a French artist now. So, are you having to learn different languages to communicate with your artists?
No, they might have to be perfecting their English, but no.
That's and RM's work
so far.
RM's work on Scalp has been. I compare it a lot to Eduardo Risso in 100 Bullets, as far as just being a perfect dark and gritty feel for that book. And I can't, as you know, obviously you're the writer, but I almost can't imagine that book being drawn by anybody else right now.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I go back and think of different artists we talked about when we were first putting the book together, and it just seems so obvious now that Gary was the perfect choice. But that said, we also have issue 12 coming up, as drawn by John Paul Leon.
You are just pulling all of the guys out of your hat.
It's just Will Dennis at Vertigo is he's the guy who's clued into to all the great artists, especially the European artists. Vertigo's been doing a great job of pulling European artists over. But Brian Wood's books are drawn by Italian artists.
That's outstanding. So that's you're definitely coming up all aces on the artists. And I want to talk about Scout for a couple minutes. It's been one of our favorite books since really almost since the time that you announced it, that you were going to be doing basically a crime mob story set on an Indian reservation. And we got to think, okay, that sounds interesting. And then the series started coming out, and everybody at Around Comics was just blown away by it. I wanted to talk to you about, because I'm from Marion, Illinois, and there are probably very few comic book artists that would mean anything in the world to, but the character in your book that is obviously inspired by Leonard Peltier, and he was incarcerated in my hometown for a lot of years.
Well, he was also here in Kansas City for a while. He was in Leavenworth. It's a frustrating case if you know about it. It just seems so obvious that this man was not guilty of the crimes he was convicted of. Never been able to get a break in terms of appeals.
I was going to ask you, give a little bit of background on Leonard Peltier and how the character that he's inspired in your book kind of fits into Scalp.
Well, Peltier was a member of the American Indian Movement back in the 70s, and there was a period back then on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota where it was just a war zone. It had the highest murder rate per capita in the country at that time. Just infighting between the tribal government and these militant traditionalists. And the FBI, of course, was very involved in... It was, 1975, I think, when two federal agents were murdered, shot at close range after a shootout. Leonard Peltier was eventually convicted of those crimes after two or three other AIM members had been tried and acquitted. Suddenly the FBI decided that Peltier had been the mastermind and the lone culprit in these two murders. And, I, like a lot of other people, feel that he was railroaded. There was no doubt that he was at the scene, that he was maybe involved in this shootout, but there's no evidence that he was the person who committed these murders. And, for this time, the manhunt that eventually brought these AIM members to trial, that was the biggest manhunt ever, biggest FBI manhunt ever up until, I think the hunt for Timothy McVeigh. So, they were definitely looking for somebody to make a scapegoat for those crimes.
Sure, and people are still very active to this day in trying to get him freed, and he gets roadblocked one after the other. I want to talk about how you've used his real-life circumstances in Scalped.
In terms of the influence of Peltier's story and the American Indian movement, yeah, it's obviously heavily influenced by the situation on Pine Ridge from the 70s, and we've taken a lot of that and, you know, moved it to the present in some sense. I mean, I think in terms of, the morally ambiguous characters, pretty much anybody in Scalped, I think at different times you can see him as the good guy, different times you can see him as the bad guy. You know, and those are the kind of characters that I love. I think those are realistic characters. I just don't see things in terms of black and white. See everything as just this mix of gray, and so I love those kind of conflicted, ambiguous characters.
There's redeemable qualities in quote unquote the bad guys in the series, and yet the good guys, there's a lot of reasons that you just really don't want to like them either.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, to me, as a reader, I just eat that shit up. You know, I love that. James Ellroy is just a master of crafting these just ingenious, flawed characters who, you know, it's just so great to watch them try to struggle to succeed and fail. Yeah, so that's definitely one of the world I've been trying to create with Scalped and fictional militant Indian rights organization.
It's talking about flawed characters. I'm in the middle of catching up on The Wire, like four seasons of The Wire.
Oh, yeah.
Are you a fan of the show?
Oh yeah, that's probably become pretty much my favorite TV show of all time. It's just an incredible show.
And I like The Wire for the same reasons I like Scalped. Is that, you know, in The Wire there are no characters that are without blemish. And even the guys that you're supposed to, it's like, don't want to spoil this for anyone, but it's like, I was even rooting for Stringer Bell kind of at the end a little bit.
he's at times a really likable guy.
Yeah.
It's you feel for him and you see what he's trying to do, and it's not working out for him. And you know, and you look at somebody like McNulty, who's, I guess, as big a hero as the show would have, and he's a total asshole at times. A lot of the time,
he's an alcoholic. He cheats on his wife,
and he has no qualms about fucking over anybody to get what he wants, even the people who are his friends and his coworkers.
Sure, and it's almost a joke to him whenever he does it. Not really, but almost.
He's a guy, you know, he's obviously not going to change. He's not going to stop doing what he does.
I
love that show. Yeah, that's absolutely what I've been trying to do with Scalped. From the get-go, The Wire was a big influence. But also in terms of the scope of it, you know, with The Wire, just the scope of that show is incredible. You get so many different perspectives just from every facet of the drug trade in Baltimore. You know, to a smaller scale, that's what we're trying to do with Scalped.
I wanted to ask you if you have a definite ending in mind for Scalped, or if it's going to be a series that you're just going to write for as long as you have stories to tell.
Yeah, it has a definite ending in mind. I think any story with Vertigo, when you pitch it, they want to know that you've got an ending in mind, mm-hmm. because that's what they're looking for. Self-contained stories. But in terms of issue numbers, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, good.
I've never put out a specific issue. As long as we got stories to tell that work within that framework of that arc.
So whenever you get to issue 200 on it, and they're like, so Jason, you got an ending in mind? You're like, yeah, we're almost there. You just kind of keep stringing them along.
At that point, if we get to issue 200, I'll just be shitting them out to pay for my swimming pool, I think.
Whoa.
It'd be time to pull the plug by then. But, I mean, there are definite arcs in mind for all of these characters. Even the ones that might at first glance seem to be, you know, not that important. Everything's moving to a specific place. And in terms of how long it takes us to get there, I can't say.
Great. Well, one thing I definitely want to mention about Scalped is that you have a great incentive for people that are maybe on the fence about reading it. And as much as we and a lot of other podcasts and just people around comics have talked about it, you really shouldn't be on the fence. If you like any sort of crime drama, The Scalped is a really great series to jump into. But tell folks a little bit about the extra incentive you have for them to try out the first trade.
Well, basically, it's just if you buy it and you don't like it, you can mail it to me and I'll give you your money back. It's as simple as that. You know, and I did that just because, you know, lately there's been so much flack and negative talk about Vertigo series, about how Vertigo seems to be having a hard time to launch new projects, and people are kind of shooting books down even before they're, you know, could really get out of the gate. And, you know, if you look back at the history of Vertigo, I mean, now, you know, you see all the huge talents that have come through there, from Gaiman and Morrison and Ennis and Ellis and Vaughn, just everybody.
Sure.
But, you know, most of those guys, when they started with Vertigo, people had never heard of them. You know, people didn't know who Brian Azzarello was when he started 100 Bullets. You know, even I, as a reader, I didn't pick up 100 Bullets number one when it was brand new on the shelf. I think it was issue like 7 or 8 before I finally started picking it up. Same with Why the Last Man.
Sure, that's kind of turned into the, I don't want to say the model, but it's kind of the Vertigo model, is that for some reason it's turned into the wait for the trade arm of DC's publishing. And, you know, that everything does come out in single issues, but it's become very in vogue for people to say, oh, I buy Vertigo series in trade. And it's kind of hard to see how a series is doing if people are waiting for the trade or waiting for, you know, two trades to come out and then jump into it. And I think that's where some of the flack has come. I don't know, you know, I don't know what Vertigo's business is like. I don't know if anyone, you know, besides the people that really know the numbers know that. But if there's any line of books that has a track record for putting out quality product with top-notch creators, I can't think of anyone that has a better resume than Vertigo.
Oh, sure. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think even beyond just the monthly versus the trade debate, with Vertigo, just traditionally you're talking about a lot of unknown creators and new concepts, which new concepts are always hard to sell. And sometimes it just takes a little bit for a book to find its audience.
Yeah, but that's one of the things that's great about Vertigo, is that they have books that aren't for everyone. I feel like they're books for me, but, you know, that's just me, I guess.
Sure, yeah, every Vertigo book is not going to be to everyone's taste, but I think if you can't find anything in there that you like, then you're just not looking hard enough. There's such a diversity of work put out by Vertigo that, I mean, if you love to read anything, I think you can find something there that you enjoy.
Absolutely.
You know, and with Scalped, you know, I've been frustrated by all this negative flack about Vertigo, but at the same time, I've been really happy with what's been going on with Scalped. You know, the you look at just the monthly issue numbers, and they're not that great, like a lot of people have pointed out. But the trade paperback has sold really, really well. The first volume. You know, I don't want people to not pick up the book because they think, you know, like with a lot of new books, they say, well, I don't want to start buying that because it's going to get canceled at issue 12. And that's part of why I'm doing the money-back guarantee, is I want to take away people's excuses for not picking it up. I want you to have no reason not to at least give it a shot. So if you give it a shot and don't like it, send it to me. I'll buy it back from you. For my address and details and everything, you can go to scalped.info.
And I hope that you get none back, and you shouldn't.
None so far, but, you know, I mean, you know, if somebody doesn't like it, they don't like it. That's fine. Like I said, I don't expect it to be to everybody's taste, but I just want people to, you know, to take a chance on it and give us an opportunity. You know, and the buzz on the book has been tremendous. You know, people like you guys, you know, you guys have been plugging it, like you said, from the get-go. And, you know, we've gotten just rave reviews from guys like Brian Vaughn and Brian Wood and Garth Dennis, who wrote the introduction for the second trade paperback, which comes out in February. And I'm having a blast doing it. So
well, I want to talk real quickly about your other series that came out right before Scalp, and that was The Other Side. Everyone's hopefully had a chance to read it. How's the feedback been on The Other Side?
It's been great. I hear from a lot of people who that's just been one of their favorite books for the last couple of years, which is incredibly gratifying. And I've been trying to do a lot of store signings, small conventions lately, and seems like every one of them, there are one or two vets who, Vietnam vets, who'll come to the show who've read the book, which of course is always incredibly gratifying. So yeah, the reception to that book has been incredible, and that book is the reason I have a comic book writing career. That's kind of the thing that started everything for me.
Sure, and I don't want to go on too much about The Other Side, but I do want to let people know that if you're interested in hearing more about The Other Side, we talked about it really extensively about a year ago, and you can still grab that podcast in our archives. But we talked a lot about the book, and Cameron Stewart, the artist, actually took a trip to Vietnam to get a lot of source material for the art, and there are great stories about your it's cousin, correct? Wrote the book that would eventually become Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, and there's info about all that in the trade paperback. There's a piece I wrote about my cousin. There's photos and Cameron's travel log from his trip to Vietnam. There's an introduction by Captain Del Dye, who is the technical advisor on Platoon and Saving Private Ryan. I was really, really happy with that trade paperback.
Well, hey, I want to talk about one other writing project of yours before we wrap up here, and that is the Top Cow pilot series and your work on Ripclaw.
Yeah, well, I did the first book in the pilot season program, which was a Ripclaw one-shot. And starting sometime next month, I think, is when fans can go vote as to which of those one-shots they'd like to see more of.
Now, if that wins, will you be writing that series? Is that how does that work?
Yeah, if it wins, I'll definitely be writing it. It would be a mini series. Mm-hmm. I would definitely be writing next year.
They're not going to pull a fast one where you vote for the book and then they bring on a totally different creative team.
Unless they pull a fast one on me. I'm not doing that. Yeah, I would definitely be on board if it wins.
Now, Ripclaw, kind of an interesting combination of a couple of your projects. It's kind of like a Wolverine meets Scalped.
That's right, yeah.
Because Ripclaw is a very Wolverine-like character, but he's a Native American.
Yeah, and with the book, I tried to give him a different kind of slant, to distance him a little bit from Wolverine. And I had a lot of fun doing it. If you read it, it's also kind of reminiscent of The Other Side in terms of the way we mix the gritty reality with the supernatural elements.
I think you surprised Sal on that book. We have our top of the stack every week, and we talk about Sal and I work together, and I'm like, what's your top of the stack? And he looked at me, he's like, Ripclaw. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, Jason Aaron wrote it. I'm like, get out of here. And he made me read it and really enjoyed it. It had a really fun twist ending that you may or may not have seen coming, but I thought it was a really fun twist at the end there. What's it like whenever, and you did it with Wolverine as well, what's it like just jumping into a one-shot story where it's a one-and-done story? Do you like doing that?
Yeah, I like doing both of those. I wouldn't want to do that all the time. It's nice to be able to spread things out a little bit. But, with those two in particular, I had a great time. The Wolverine, it was great to be able to tell a story that was a little bit different than a lot of the Wolverine stories lately and had a different focus. But, that said, the Wolverine story I'm writing right now, the four-parter, is very different from that one-shot. It's, very Wolverine-centric. Flashes back to a different point in its history and is reaction driven. So, I just love doing different things. I love mixing stuff up. The first book I did after working on the other side in Scalped was the Friday the 13th two-parter I did for Wildstorm.
Oh, that's right.
Which was a blast.
pretty easy to find research material for that. Was it Friday the 13th marathon night at your house, getting ready for that?
No, I watched all those religiously back when I was, 13, 14, so I had my research down pat for that.
That explains a lot about you, Jason.
Great, thanks. Take that as a compliment. No, it was great to go from, like we talked about, the other side, and scouts were both pretty research heavy, to do it Friday the 13th, where I was like, great, I don't need to do anything for this.
Well, Jason, it is always a pleasure talking with you. It's been a lot of fun to see everything that's happened to you in the past year and all the great work that you've been putting out. And it looks like 2008 is going to be even more exciting as we see you get into a little bit more mainstream stuff, but still stay with your series at Vertigo.
Yeah, it should be an exciting year, and February is the going to be a big month for me. That's when Wolverine, Ghost Rider, and the second scalp trade all hit that month. So February, Jason Aaron month next year. mark it on your calendar.
All Jason Aaron all the time. All right, well, Jason, once again, thank you so much, and we'll check back with you in February and check in on all the cool projects and see what else is coming up for you later in the year.
That sounds great. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Have a good night, man. It's always good to hear from Jason Aaron. I'm sure you'll hear from him again on the show, and definitely check out his work at the local comic shop. You will thank yourself for doing it. And now it's time to get you caught up on the week's events. Here is Around Comics' own Brian Salazar with Wire to Wire comic book news.
This is Wire to Wire comic book news top headlines for the week of November 12th, 2007. Longtime Marvel penciler Mark Bagley, whose current exclusive contract with the publisher reportedly expires at the end of this year, will move to DC Comics to take on an undisclosed high-profile project, likely sometime in 2008. Bagley's name has been synonymous with Marvel Comics since the literal start of his career, going back to 1986. At the time, the then aspiring 27-year-old artist submitted an entry to Marvel Editor-in-Chief Jim Shooter's Marvel Tryout Book, winning the penciling entry, which led to his first professional assignments with the publisher. Random House's Keith Clayton has acquired World English rights from Marvel Entertainment to four books based on their iconic superhero Iron Man. Two books will be direct tie-ins to the Iron Man film from Marvel Studios, including the official adult novelization of the movie, and a non-fiction title featuring an inside look at the upcoming film, as well as material on the creation of the character and his history in the comic book world. They will be released in the weeks prior to the film's U.S. debut on May 2, 2008. Two books will be original Iron Man novels focusing on the classic Iron Man character and will be released at a future date. Taking a cue from Radiohead and other forward-thinking music acts, digital graphic novel publisher Ambrosia Publishing is now offering you the opportunity to pay what you want for the digital versions of the following graphic novels at the Ambrosia Publishing store: Clockwork Creature, Chapter 1 by Kyle Stram, Smuggling Spirits, Book 1 by Ben Fisher and Mike Henderson, and They Do Not Die by Scott O. Brown and Horatio Lalia. Each title is available in PDF, CBZ, or ebook format, with some being available for your iPod or PSP. Marvel Comics has unveiled their long-awaited digital comics service. The comic book industry makes a long-delayed step into cyberspace this week when Marvel Comics unveiled the industry's first online archive of more than 2,500 back issues, including the first appearances of Spider-Man, the X-Men, and the Incredible Hulk. Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited will offer the archive in a high-resolution format on computer screens for $59.88 a year or at a monthly rate of $9.99, all available at Marvel.com. While the comics cannot be downloaded and must be viewed at the Marvel.com website, it is a step in the right direction for digital distribution. Dabble Brothers Publishing and Del Rey, an imprint of Valentine Books, have announced a new agreement for distribution of Dabble Brothers graphic novels into the trade book market. In spring 2008, the popular literary comic book publisher will launch comic book adaptations of three major properties: New York Times bestselling author Dean Koontz's Frankenstein, Prodigal Son, Jim Butcher's bestselling The Dresden Files, and George R.R. Martin's Wild Cards. The graphic novel versions, to be distributed by Del Rey, will go on sale in summer-fall of 2008. After 25 years of being published in a traditional saddle-stitched magazine format released three or four times a year, the award-winning Love and Rockets comic book series will go on hiatus effective immediately and return next summer in its third incarnation as a series of all-original graphic novel-length releases. Each annual volume will comprise at least 100 pages of all new comics, split evenly between its creators. This new format will allow the brothers to present longer stories without having to chop them down into bite-sized pieces, said Fantagraphics publisher Gary Groth. In today's graphic novel-oriented world, readers and cartoonists are increasingly impatient with this sort of serialization, especially in the case of Love and Rockets, where because of the split nature of the book, each artist has only 15 pages. 4 months after Marvel Comics unexpectedly killed off the red, white, and blue leader of the Avengers, Captain America, he reappears in a comic made exclusively for U.S. soldiers. Captain America is not being resurrected in Spirit of America, said Bob Sabowney, Marvel's Vice President of Business Development. But when the AAFES asked Marvel officials to include the hero in the latest military issue to be released before Veterans Day, they agreed because no other character better symbolizes the heroism and patriotism of the American soldier. 1 million copies of the New Avengers: The Spirit of America, the fifth in Marvel's series for the military, will be available free at military-based stores worldwide. Some recent signing news from Marvel and DC. Spanish artist Daniel Acuña, the now formerly DC exclusive artist who has done the majority of his American work for DC Comics, will be headed to Marvel Comics in 2008. Best known for his work on titles like Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters and his cover work, Acuña was slated to be the regular artist on DC's The Flash along with returning writer Mark Waid, but his run turned out to be abbreviated, perhaps due to his taking a Marvel assignment. Meanwhile, DC Comics has signed writer-artist Keith Giffen to an exclusive contract. Giffen has been a longtime creative voice for DC, creating characters such as Lobo and Ambush Bug, as well as contributing to seminal runs of Legion of Superheroes and Justice League as both a writer and an artist in the 80s and 90s. Recent projects have included creating and writing the current Blue Beetle series and writing the Wildstorm series Midnighter and the DCU Limited series 52 Aftermath, The Four Horsemen. Hasbro has solicited proposals from potential publishers of the next G.I. Joe comic book license beginning this past summer, and will be making a decision on a license sometime after the end of the year. Rumors began to circulate in recent weeks suggesting the license, which has been with Devil's Due Publishing since 2001, was available. Mike Serbian, a representative of Hasbro's public relations agency, Hunter PR, recently confirmed it was indeed up for grabs. The G.I. Joe license is up for renewal. Hasbro's partner Devil's Due will be publishing the American's Elite storyline until July of 2008. Hasbro solicited proposals at Comic-Con International, currently have a number of them in-house, and will be deciding on the Joe Comics partner post-Thanksgiving. No decisions have yet been made. Based on sales of the top 300 comics, comic sales by Diamond to comic stores in October were up 20% over October 2006. Graphic novels were up a more modest 6%, bringing the total growth rate for the month to 17% versus October of 2006. The increase in comic sales was not due to strength at the top of the list, however, where results were uninspiring, but big-time growth in the bottom half of the list brought up the overall growth rate. For example, Kong, King of Skull Island number 0, which was the number 300 title in October 2007, sold more than twice as many of the number 300 title in October 2006. In fact, you had to go up 64 ranks to the 236th title in 2006 to match the sales of a 2007 title. Those are your top comic book headlines. This has been Wire to Wire Comic Book News.
Yeah.
set for the week ahead. Here is Chris Marshall from the Collected Comics Library with this week's new trade paperback and collected edition releases.
So it's Thanksgiving here in the United States, and it officially kicks off the Christmas buying season. So while you're out shopping this Black Friday, why not go out and pick up your favorite comics from DC and Marvel and the rest? And here's a little rundown of them for you. Jack Kirby's Fourth World Omnibus Volume 3 is out. This collects The New Gods 7 through 10, Forever People 7 through 10, Jimmy Olsen 146 through 148, and Mr. Miracle 7 through 10. 52 Volume 4, the trade is out, collecting weeks 40 through 52. That is for $20. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago, it looks like DC decided to wait for the fourth volume of 52 to release this book. This is World War III, the trade, for $18, and this collects the four parts of World War III, of course. Batman Death in the City trade paperback is out, and this is for $15, collecting Detective Comics 827 through 834. Supergirl Identity for $20, collecting Supergirl 10 through 19, and the Infinite Holiday Special number 1. We also have American Version Volume 3 for $13. That collects 10 through 14 of that series. Over at Marvel, we've got Ultimates 2, the hardcover, collecting 1 through 13, and Ultimates 2, number 1, the Variant Sketch Edition. That is only for $35. Annihilation Book 3, the trade paperback, is out, collecting Annihilation 1 through 6, Annihilation Heralds of Galactus 1 and 2, and Annihilation Nova Corps files for $25. Also from Jeff Parker, we've got X-Men First Class Tomorrow's Brightest trade, collecting that 8-issue series. That is only for $20. And Spider-Girl Presents Wild Thing Crash Course Digest. This collects Wild Thing 0 through 5 and is for $8. A couple other books that are supposed to come out from Marvel, but they are not on this week's preliminary list that I got over at Comic List, would be X-Men God Loves, Man Kills, the premier hardcover classic edition. This is the variant volume number 7. New Avengers Volume 1, the hardcover, both the regular and the variant edition. Marvel Adventures Fantastic Four Volume 1, the hardcover. And we also have a second printing of a masterwork. This is Fantastic Four Volume 7 and the variant edition 34. This collects Fantastic Four 61 through 71 and annual number 5 of the original Kirby Lee run. Over at Dark Horse, we've got Hellboy Volume 7, The Troll Witch, and Others trade for $18. From Image, we got Madman Volume 2, The Trade, collecting Madman Comics 1 through 11. It is $18, and it is a whopping 328 pages. We are also expecting from IDW the complete Chester Gould's Dick Tracy Volume 3. Volume 1 and Volume 2 also get a second printing this week. And in case you haven't picked up your copy of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the Black Dossier, you may want to do that. I checked with my local comic book shop, and Brian, who's a good friend of mine who owns a store, told me that he had ordered 8 copies that he was going to put on his shelf, and all 8 of those sold out last Wednesday in a matter of 2 hours. So if you didn't get your copy, boy, it's sure a hot ticket item, and you may want to pick it up as, you know, as soon as possible. As for me, I have not gotten my copy in my hands yet, but I do have it coming from DCBS, and you're probably wondering, Chris, which one did you pick up? And as much as I like the variant cover on the Black Dossier, I have to say that I went with the black cover because, well, my Black Dossier is going to be black and not pink. So for Around Comics, I'm Chris Marshall, Collected Comics Library, and happy Thanksgiving.
Chris Marshall is the host of the Collected Comics Library podcast. You can find the podcast, release schedules, and checklists of everything collected at collectedcomicslibrary.com.
Let her go!
For all of the traditionalists like myself that still like to buy their comics in single editions, here is a preview of what is going to be hitting comic shops this Wednesday. Please note that these are just highlights of issues that will be coming out this week, and shipping dates are subject to change without notice. From Dark Horse Comics, we have the Umbrella Academy Apocalypse Suite number 3 of 6. This is the Gerard Way, the front man for My Chemical Romance, and Gabriel Ba of Casanova fame. This is their mini-series. Coming out from DC Comics, we have the continuation of the Legion storyline in Action Comics with number 859. And around comics favorite, Brave and the Bold number 8 is due out this week, as is Will Pfeiffer's Catwoman number 73. We also have the Greg Rucka written Checkmate number 20. Ex Machina comes out under the Wildstorm imprint. The Flash number 234. Mike Norton takes over art duties on Metamorpho Year 1 number 4, and that is 4 of 6. Also have The Program, number 5 of 12. Shadow Pack keeps rolling on with issue 19. The Spirit hits number 11 as we prepare for the departure of Darwin Cook. And we'll wrap up our DC highlights with Rick Veitch's Army at Love, number 9. Dynamite Entertainment releases The Boys, number 12 this week. Moving over to Image, we have Casanova, number 11. That's the Matt Fraction and now Fabio Moon-drawn Casanova. Godland, number 20. The Walking Dead, number 44. And a special note, one that I've really been looking forward to, is B. Claymore's Hawaiian Dick, number 1, comes out this week. And that is the first in the ongoing Hawaiian Dick series. If you're a fan of noir-style PI detective stories, check out Hawaiian Dick. And for me, at least, it looks like a pretty light week at Marvel. We have Captain America, number 32. Powers, number 27. Finally, the Ultimate Vision series wraps up with number 5 of 5. We have Wolverine Origins, number 19, and What If? Annihilation. And wrapping up this week's highlights, I want to mention that back issue, number 25, from Tomorrow's Publishing, will also be coming out on this Wednesday. So enjoy your trip to the comic shop this week and your long holiday weekend, if you have one. And always remember to ask your local comic shop manager or owner if the Thanksgiving holiday will affect their shipping dates for the next week. Sometimes that'll happen, and you won't get your new books on the Wednesday after Thanksgiving. So make sure and ask them, and that will hopefully save you some problems in the following week. So have a good week at the local comic shop. Perhaps the hardest question in all of comicdom to answer is, what is the deal with Hawkman? I don't understand it. I don't know anyone that does understand it. If they say they do, they're probably lying to you. It's one of the most convoluted histories of any character in comics. To even try and go to the Wikipedia page and figure it out is confusing enough. But the character itself has been depicted in a lot of different ways. And to get into the mind, to try and understand the character of Hawkman, our very own Tom Caters is here to give you a reading from Inside Hawkman's Diary.
A reading from Hawkman's Journal, July 1973. Even though I helped build this satellite, I feel like a stranger in my own home. I know the other League members make fun of me behind my back. I found that Nixon bumper sticker that was attached to my harness. I'm an alien. I don't even vote for the president. Yet, my beliefs seem to alienate some of the other members. Especially Green Arrow. I know he's been trying on my wings lately, because the straps are all adjusted. They're way too tight when I put it on, and he's always the one that laughs the hardest when he sees me struggling to fix it. He also keeps leaving his Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young albums on the record player. Now me, I'm more of a old-school big band type guy, or marching band. A good Philip Sousa song is all I need to get going. But he likes his liberal stuff. And I'm cool with it, I just wish You know, he'd get his own record player, and he wouldn't use the one in the main room. It's got my name labeled on it. He borrows my mace without asking. I know, because I always find it in his room, or in his office, or in the bathroom in his office. You shouldn't take another man's mace into a bathroom, ever. Just never. He also used my Thanagarian time shears to trim his beard. I noticed, because there's all kinds of little blonde hairs caught in it. It wouldn't be that bad, except he even forgot to oil it after he used it, so it's just gonna get rusty. And those things are expensive. It's not like I can just make one whenever I want. I have to order those way ahead of time. Alas, I think my time here is coming to an end. I should go. The only thing that keeps me around is my good friend Aquaman. He too feels like an outsider. Many a night I've sat and watched him sleep in his room. I don't know if he knows. I like to think he would. The way that he doesn't mention it to anyone. When I climb into the bed with him and get right next to him, but never touch, never ever touch him. I like to think that even though I'm a creature of the air and he's a creature of the water, that real meeting of the minds. I have to go to bed now. Good night.
Around Comics is proud to help support the Hero Initiative. Hero creates a financial safety net for yesterday's creators who need emergency medical aid, financial support for essentials of life, and an avenue back into paying work. It's a chance for all of us to give back something to the people who have given us so much enjoyment. For more information, visit www.heroinitiative.org or call 310-909-7809. Comics aren't just in comic shops and bookstores anymore. Now you can find literally thousands of webcomics online. Jeremy Mullins is here to save you hours of searching on the internet by telling us where to find the best and brightest in the ever-changing world of webcomics.
Okay, this week I'd like to kick it a little bizarro. I want to recommend Dinosaur Comics by Ryan North. This comic is really odd and really quirky, but a lot of fun. Each strip features the exact same six panels of crudely drawn dinosaurs each and every time. They're shown talking amongst themselves, stepping on a house, stepping on a small woman, but the only thing that changes with each new update is the dialogue. Does that sound boring or uncreative? It's not at all. Dinosaur Comics is a shining star of the constrained comics movement. Sequential art that places some fundamental constraint on form, in much the same way that haikus or sonnets are constrained forms of poetry. Characters include T-Rex, who's like a really big know-it-all. Utah Raptor is always shown in the later panels and generally takes an adversarial stance against T-Rex's daily diatribe. And then there's a third, very friendly female dinosaur. By working in this constrained architecture, Ryan North deserves some mad props for coming up with creative and funny stuff in such a tightly defined boundary. Each comic contains three hidden Easter eggs. The first one can be seen by holding the cursor over the comic itself. The second is found in the subject line of the comment's email address. And the third is the comic's title, which can be found in the RSS feed or the archive page. Dinosaur Comics was named one of the best webcomics by the Webcomics Examiner, and it won Best Anthropomorphic Webcomic in the 2005 Web Cartoonist's Choice Awards. Dinosaur Comics has seen print in two collected volumes, as well as several newspapers. You can find it at quants.com, Q-U-A-N-T-Z.com. Once there, click the giant ugly dinosaur to see the comics. New comics are posted on weekdays, and if you're interested in the Constrained Comics movement, check out The Angriest Dog in the World by David Lynch. It was one of the very first Constrained Comics. It appeared from 1983 to 1992 in the LA Weekly. You can find scans of the work at davidlynch.de/angry.html. That address, one more time, is davidlynch.de/angry.html. For Around Comics, I'm Jeremy W. Mullins.
Jeremy Mullins is a professor of sequential art at the Savannah College of Art and Design. You can find more about the school and their programs of study at www.scad.edu.
It's Tom, you ask, and I tell you. This week, I'm in Detroit, it's the middle of the day, I've had a few drinks, hanging out by myself, waiting for my girlfriend to be done doing something. So I figured I'll record this, another Answer Man segment for you. So let's get to it. This question this week is from Chewy. Dear Tom, this is a great question. Well, congratulations. No doubt many fans want to know, why can there never be a Marvel-DC crossover? Seems from what I've heard that there's no animosity between the two publishers. Stan Lee has even been allowed to interpret DC's characters to his fitting, yet the two universes have never clashed, as far as I know. It seems to me that it would be the ultimate concoction. Spider-Man meets up with Batman, Superman vs. the Hulk, Supergirl does Ms. Marvel, etc. The two companies always seem to want to outdo each other, but only wind up doing the same things over and over. Remember when WCW and WWF were two separate entities? One day they merged and the possibilities grew. Why can't that happen with Marvel and DC? Thanks, Chewie. I love this question because it's like someone came up to me and said, I'm hungry and I want this. And then they described pizza. And then I was able to take them into a kitchen and give them a piping hot pizza. Because, Chewy, my friend, there has been plenty of crossovers between Marvel and DC. You got to remember, even back towards the beginning of comic bookdom, crossovers have been important. You know, the JSA was created out of an intercompany crossover. And over the years, there have been many unofficial crossovers between Marvel and DC. The Squadron Supreme, which I believe Roy Thomas created, was very much an homage of the Justice League in the Avengers. The event in Justice League, there was an issue once where I think it was a Len Wein written one where they went to Rutland, Vermont, and there was a Halloween costume party, and people were dressed up like Marvel characters, and they ended up fighting the JLA. So you had a little bit of a crossover there. Characters like the Champions of Angor, like Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress, are also homages to the Avengers, which is sort of interesting because in the new miniseries, Lord Havoc and the Extremists, you can kind of see that takes place on supposedly based on the same Earth where the Champions of Angor are from, and it's also sort of an homage towards Civil War, so you can see a little bit of that playing around with crossovers there. It's been going on even past that. The Imperial Guard and the X-Men are homages to the Legion of Superheroes. But, I mean, those are all homages. Those aren't official. They're just sort of in-jokes for people in the know. The first official crossover between Marvel and DC was actually a Wizard of Oz adaptation. It didn't use any of the characters from either one of the universes, but it sort of paved the way in the late 70s, early 80s, for more official crossovers, like Superman versus The Amazing Spider-Man in 1976 was the first official one. We had Marvel Treasury Edition number 28, which is Superman and Spidey fighting Parasite and Doctor Doom. And that was 1981. I find it very odd. Parasite and Doctor Doom wouldn't necessarily be the ones I would pick. I would pick Lex Luthor and Doctor Doom, but... Yeah, that's me. I didn't write it, so what? You had DC Special Series number 27 with Batman versus the Incredible Hulk. I've never read this, and in fact, I don't even know how it ends. But I bet Batman wins because he had time to prep, and that was in 81. You had X-Men and the New Teen Titans in 82. And then for a number of years, you didn't see any crossovers between the big two. They had planned a JLA Avengers, I think, like in 83, and George Perez had even started... drawing it, and there was some tension between Jim Shooter and I believe Dick Giordano at the time was in charge of DC. They couldn't iron out the story, and it just sort of faded away. Then once the boom of the 90s happened, you saw a lot of crossovers. So Batman and Punisher, like in 94, you saw it a couple times. You had Darkseid versus Galactus. You had Spider-Man and Batman, Green Lantern and Silver Surfer. If you look at the list, God, there's tons. And it's not just, you know, Marvel and DC at that same time. You had a lot of Image and Wildstorm characters crossing over. I mean, I think there was more Supreme crossovers than there were actual issues of Supreme. My favorite one being Archie Meets the Punisher, which came out in 94. And I think there was too many of them. Sort of the fun of a crossover comes from the fact that you haven't seen it before. So when you're seeing it constantly, it sort of burns out and kind of doesn't have any flair to it. You know, you had stuff like the Amalgam Comics, which was literally taking Marvel characters and DC characters and putting them together and telling stories. And while it's kind of a cool idea... it doesn't have legs to it, really. It becomes a little too... I don't want to say in-jokey, because it's not like a joke, but I think the characters have their own innate being to them. And part of the fun of a crossover is seeing how a character like Spider-Man is very different from a character like Superman. And you play up those differences in that story, but the more you see them together, the more that sort of gets mixed, and it's not as fun to see those differences played out anymore. I do have a couple crossovers, actually, that I really enjoy a lot. There's a Batman, Hellboy, and Starman, I think from the late 90s, early 2000s, that I really enjoyed. And my favorite is JLA Avengers by Busiek and George Perez. It has sort of an absolute edition out now. I don't know how hard it is to find. It came out in, like, four prestige style issues. To me, that is my favorite crossover of all of them. It's very well written, very well drawn. I mean, Perez, you know, say what you will about him, he's the king of jamming a thousand things into a page. So you get to see the whole Marvel universe and the whole DC universe. You get to see the characters interact. You get to see, what Superman thinks of the Marvel universe. He thinks the heroes of the Marvel universe don't do enough. And Captain America thinks that the DC Universe heroes maybe do too much for humanity. So you see those sort of crossing between the two. You get great, you know, fight sequences. You can see, you know, Flash whoop up on Quicksilver, which makes me smile every time I read it because I hate Quicksilver. But that's a topic for a different podcast. But there are plenty of options out there for you if you're interested in these crossovers. A lot of the 90s ones are pretty easy to find if you're interested in them. The older ones, I think they've been collected in trade paperbacks. And the one that I would really suggest is the JLA Avengers by Busiek and George Perez. Comes in a sort of an absolute style one, and you can still find the single issues like on eBay and at stores. So if you have any questions, I enjoyed this one because I feel like for once I can give someone a really satisfying answer, you know. And I can't make Hawkman make sense, but I can tell someone about all the great crossovers. So if you have any more questions, especially ones that you think I can actually, you know, solve for you, send an email to tom@aroundcomics, and I will talk to all of you later. Bye.
When he's not writing the continuing adventures of Catwoman, Will Pfeiffer is a DVD and movie reviewer for the Rockford Register-Star. Here's Will to tell us about what's happening in DVDs this week.
This week's big Hollywood DVD release is Live Free or Die Hard, the fourth in the Die Hard series, following its predecessor, Die Hard with a Vengeance, a mere dozen years later. A lot has changed since 1995. Bruce Willis has gone from balding to plain out bald. Kevin Smith has stopped by to make an appearance, and the studio decided to go for a PG-13 rating, meaning you'll see plenty of people get killed, but you won't quite hear John McClane's beloved catchphrase, Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Hey, I hope this podcast isn't rated PG-13. Also out this week is Hearts of Darkness, a filmmaker's apocalypse. If you've ever watched Apocalypse Now and wondered, how did they avoid going crazy making that movie? Well, the answer is they didn't really, and you can see all the insanity and fascinating detail in this documentary, which is making its long-awaited debut on DVD. Hear director Francis Ford Coppola talk about killing himself. See star Martin Sheen slice open his hand while filming a scene. Watch Marlon Brando show up way overweight and woefully unprepared. Wonder just how stoned Dennis Hopper really is. All that and a teenage Lawrence Fishburne long before he became Morpheus. Hearts of Darkness is such an unbelievable movie that it's almost as good as Apocalypse Now, and that's no small compliment. This week's DVD pick is another documentary, Cinemania, which focuses on movie fans who are so insanely dedicated to cinema that they make most comic book fans look like healthy, well-adjusted members of society by comparison. The five New Yorkers spotlighted in this movie go to hundreds of films a year, foregoing jobs, romance, family, and friendships to support their love of film. We follow them into theaters, we follow them home, and we follow them around the Big Apple as they desperately try to catch every movie they possibly can. One woman has an apartment packed, and I mean packed, with film festival programs, flyers, and Burger King giveaway cups. One guy has an amazing collection of movie soundtrack LPs, and no record player to listen to them on. And one guy has the phone number of several projection booths so he can call at a moment's notice and inquire about the condition of a particular print. Think comic book fans are alone in their obsession with mint condition? Think again. There are so many amazing moments in Cinemania that it's hard to pick a favorite, but I have to admit one of mine is when Jack admits he deliberately eats meals he knows will constipate him so he doesn't have to worry about leaving a movie in the middle to go to the bathroom. Now that is dedication. Cinemania is the sort of documentary that's both funny and sad. It might make you feel a little bit better about your own life, but it'll probably make you feel a whole lot worse about humanity in general. That's the DVD report, and I'm Will Pfeiffer for Around Comics.
You can find Will's written reviews at the Rockford Register Star by visiting go.rrstar.com and going to the entertainment section. You can also visit Will's blog at willpfeiffer.com. And that'll take care of another Monday edition of Around Comics, the Comic Culture Podcast. Make sure to come back on Thursday for Around Comics, the Comic Culture Roundtable. It's an informal and entertaining roundtable discussion about the world of comics and pop culture. You can visit us online at aroundcomics.com. You can contact the show via email at info@aroundcomics.com. You can also visit us at MySpace and ComicSpace, and if you like the show, you can leave a review at the iTunes Music Store. I want to thank you for listening today and making Around Comics your source for comic book news, reviews, and opinions. We'll be back again next Monday for another edition of the Comic Culture Podcast. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in and around comics. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, retransmission, or rebroadcast without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2007. Got my loving baby, love you gone. Got my love, baby, love you gone. I know you didn't love me, baby. I know you did me wrong. Let me come home. Oh, yeah. Oh, I got to love you. Loving baby one more time. Try my loving baby one more time. Oh, you got my loving baby.